I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the elements of defamation. So in this section, we will talk about each of the six elements of defamation, how to define them, what they mean, and how they work within the whole. I want to start out with the actual defamation element. There are two forms of defamation, libel per se and libel per quod. Now, as a reminder, defamation is a false statement that harms someone's reputation. And in a sense, the libel per se and libel per quod distinction is whether or not you're doing it obviously or you need context for it. Let me give you an example. Libel per se, and per se is Latin for on its face, are when words pretty much are obviously libelous. If I'm called a crook or a racist or a murderer, prostitute, adulterer, incompetent, etc., all of those are obviously libelous. In other words, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to understand that if you've been called a crook or a thief, you've actually been libeled, obviously libeled. The actual definition, legal definition, is a false accusation of crime, immorality, infection by loathsome disease, or incompetence. But libel per se is when it is obvious that libel has taken place. Libel per quod is sort of the opposite of libel per se, or the way I tend to remember it is if it is not libel per se, if it's not obvious, it must necessarily be libel per quod. Libel per quod is when it is necessary to know something more to know if something is defamatory. Okay, so the example I gave you for false light last chapter where there was a false description of Tony Fellow and me holding hands as we walked across campus, that'd be libel per quod, right? Because you would need additional context to know that that was problematic, knowing that he is married to someone else, as am I. So libel per se, you know, is libel that grabs you and slaps you across the face and says, hey, I'm libelous. Libel per quod is when you need to know additional facts or you need context. Okay? All right. Let's talk about identification. You don't have to have 100% identification. In other words, not everyone who reads the story or hears the story needs to know who the person is who's being libeled, but there's got to be at least some. That gentleman down there, of course, is our university president, Milton Gordon. Some of you may or may not have known that. But if I were to have libeled him, some of you, probably enough of you, would have known that for it to be problematic. In other words, at least some people need to know who that is. Now, there are a lot of different ways you can identify someone, and not all of them have to do simply with the name. You can be identified by title, like the governor of California. You guys all know who that is. The address, who lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Currently, it's Barack Obama. Description. The lead actor in the Indiana Jones movies? If you said Harrison Ford, you'd be right. What if I said the person that Harrison Ford, I believe, is either married to or engaged to be married to? You guys would probably know that too. That's Callista, Give That Girl a Sandwich, Flockhart. Okay? How about job? Attorney General of the United States. Currently, that's Eric Holder. Or JFK, LBJ, etc. You can even use common abbreviations in the media, like J-Lo. You guys know who J-Lo is. Or what do they use for Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie? Isn't it Brangelina? But there again, as long as some people know identification. And as we talked about, I don't necessarily have to be identified by name in the bad teacher example to be identified. You know, the woman who teaches media law, you know, or has been teaching media law at the university for the last 5 years. That would be pretty much just me. Okay, let's turn to an example of identification gone awry. This is a great case. It's a California case, lowercase, but I think it's a great example of the need to really identify closely the people you're talking about in a story. The case is called Barrett versus Times Mirror Company, and it's a 1930s case, but it could happen today just as easily. There were two doctors, Ralph A. Barrett and R. Allen Barrett, so they have the same initials, you know, almost the same last names. They both work at the same hospital. The LA Times reported that Dr. Barrett, with a T, had been arrested for stealing from the hospital and narcotics, when actually it was Dr. Barrett without the T who had. And so Dr. Barrett with a T sued and won because he had been misidentified in the story. And this, frankly, is an example of negligence. A simple phone call or a simple recheck of the court records would have given you the answer and avoided the lawsuit. Okay, let's talk about publication. Publication is usually pretty easy to get. If it's in the newspaper, if it's on a website, if it's broadcast on TV, if it's a place where people can, you know, readily access it, it's published. The actual legal definition is victim plus source plus one other party. Now, students often ask me, well, what if I just whisper it to one other person? Well, you know, that's under the legal definition, yes, but the damages are a lot less if fewer people hear it. If I'm standing with a student, you know, maybe on a street corner or having coffee in a coffee shop, and a person is libeled, that's two people hearing it. But now if it gets published in the Daily Titan or the LA Times or something bigger yet, or even online, that has the potential of many thousands or millions of people hearing it. Okay, so the fewer people who hear it, the less damages that are suffered. It should have a star next to it. It doesn't. Republishing libel, even accurately and with your sources, does not exempt you from liability. Sometimes students will say to me, well, you know, I quoted the guy directly when he said that the mayor was a thief. You know, I quoted him, I cited him, it was all on the record. Well, that's nice, but again, because you gave that libel a forum to be broadcast or printed or published to a whole bunch of people other than just yourself, you have liability for republication of libel. Okay, so even if you're quoting someone correctly, that doesn't mean that you are off the hook for libel. I get students asking me that every single semester. Well, if I'm quoting someone accurately, they're on the hook, not me. Wrong. A smart attorney will sue you all and let the judge sort it out. There is something, however, called the single publication rule. Now, there's about, I believe we publish between, I think it's about 4,000 copies of the Daily Titan, and I'm sure we get many, many, many more web hits on it. So if I am libeled in the Daily Titan, I only have one lawsuit. I cannot file suit for every single copy of the paper or every hit on the website. Okay? So I get one. Basically, if it's no matter how many copies there are of a newspaper or how many views or hits on a website, I only get one court case. Because people, of course, in the past tried to sue, saying, well, if there were, you know, 500 copies of this particular paper distributed, then I have 500 ways to recover money. And the courts have said no. It's called a single publication rule. All right. Let's talk about falsity. Prior to 1964, again, the magic year, falsity was assumed for the plaintiff. The defendant had to prove that it hadn't libeled someone, all right, that it hadn't printed anything that was false. But now the burden of proof after 1964 has shifted to the plaintiff. And the case that established that is Philadelphia Newspapers versus Heps. Didn't really establish it, but it cast it by the Supreme Court. Maurice Heps was a kind of a shady guy living in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote a story about him, suggesting that he might be linked to organized crime. He sues for libel. The jury thinks that he can't prove that what the Inquirer printed was false necessarily, but neither could the reporters prove that it was true. So there was a tie, and the tie goes to the media. I'll say that again. In a question of truth, for that element, falsity, if there is a tie, if the jury isn't sure, the default goes to the media. Again, because the plaintiff has the burden of proof. The plaintiff is the one who has to make his or her case. And if the plaintiff can't prove falsity, you know, you go back to my six-legged model of the, you know, libel as a table. Okay, can't prove it that way, one of those legs breaks and the libel table falls. Okay, so the actual language is where speech of public importance is concerned. All plaintiffs, public or private, have the burden of proving falsity. Okay, so falsity must be proved by the plaintiff. Now, you might think, well, truth is no big deal. You know, I can, if I print something that's true, then it's true, right? Well, I'll ask you to do this little thought experiment. Imagine trying to get a couple of your friends to decide what to do tonight. Maybe you want to go see a movie, maybe you want to go have dinner, maybe you want to go see a movie, then have dinner, then have coffee, or go out to a bar, or whatever you want to do. It's kind of hard simply to get sometimes three or four people to agree. Then you expand it to a dozen, and that gets harder yet. And then you expand it to strangers, where you don't have any pull. So even though you might think you have an ironclad case of truth, juries are really slippery beasts. You have to get them all to agree, and that's not as easy as you might think. In my bad teacher example, I would have the burden as the plaintiff of proving that what the student wrote about me was actually false. All right. Let's talk about fault. For most students, fault is the toughest area to get their minds around, and it actually is where most of libel cases hang up. Okay? There is a difference in the law between burdens of proof for private people like me and you, and public officials and public figures like celebrities or politicians. Okay? The difference is the difference between negligence and actual malice. And again, prior to 1964, prior to Sullivan, fault is assumed for the plaintiff. Okay? The defendant, the media defendant, had to prove that there was no fault, that they hadn't acted wrongly. And in Sullivan, that changed. Now, different kinds of people have different levels of fault, and it's up to the jury to determine what kind of person a liable plaintiff is. If the person is a public official, like our governor, or a public person, like a celebrity, like Britney Spears, like Angelina Jolie, like Brad Pitt, okay, those individuals must prove actual malice. I promise you, you will see this definition on many different exams. Actual malice is a two-part definition. You either know it's false and published it anyway, or, that's the magic or, acted with reckless disregard for the truth. You didn't care one way or the other, you just slapped it up there. Now, the understanding is that most journalists want to do a good job. Most media professionals want to publish things that are true because they want to build their credibility and the trust in the media organization, whether you're a journalist, public relations professional, advertiser, whatever. So, frankly, that's why it's so difficult to prove actual malice, because you actually have to dig inside their heads. And as we're going to find out, that's okay to do. You can actually put people on the stand and say, what were you thinking when you published something? And that can go to the question of whether or not the media acted with actual malice. Okay? If you are a private person, you need only prove negligence. Now, that picture at the bottom is just a random bunch of people. You know, someday some student's going to email me and say, hey, that person in the sweatshirt in the front, that's my cousin. But right now, it's just a random picture. Those are private people. There's nobody famous in that group. Those private people, and like people like me, I would argue, and you, are private. And they only have to prove negligence, sloppiness. Did you make sure that the names were spelled correctly? Are all the simple facts in your case true? Are you, implying something that isn't true that would have been easily corrected with a phone call? Negligence is a lot easier to prove than actual malice. I'll say that again. Negligence is a lot easier to prove than actual malice. And the idea behind having a double standard here is because private people don't really have the access to the media to be able to clear their good names. They should be more protected from libel suits than people who intentionally thrust themselves into the public view, like celebrities or political officials. Okay? So it is much easier for private people to win libel suits. And in my bad teacher example, as I said earlier, I would be arguing that I'm private because I want only to have to prove negligence. And the Daily Titan would be arguing that I'm public. You know, I teach big classes, I'm pretty well known in the department, I'm head of the journalism concentration. That makes me public. I don't actually know what way a jury will come down. But that would be the arguments that they would make. And if I was deemed to be private, I would have to prove, that's right, negligence. And if I am public, I would have to prove actual malice. All right. Let's talk about damages. Any plaintiff, no matter who you are, you got to prove some sort of damages to win. If there's no damages, the court is going to say, why are you wasting our time? And the judge is going to send us all home. Okay? But damages vary depending on what you're able to prove. Okay? Generally speaking, unless state law differs, punitive damages require proof of actual malice. I'll say that again. If you want to win the big money, no matter what kind of plaintiff you are, you got to prove actual malice. Now, there are some states that have differences in how this works, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But the basic rule of thumb is that if you are a private person and you manage to prove actual malice, you're going to be able to win big punitive damages. Again, punitive damages punish the media for being naughty. Okay? So in my bad teacher example, if I am considered by the jury to be a private person, but I'm still able to prove that the student acted with actual malice, I might be able to win big punitive damages, other than just my compensatory damages that would compensate me for my lost wages, maybe I had doctor bills, whatever. Okay, so again, to remind you quickly, compensatory damages compensate for lost damages that you can prove with receipts and the like. Punitive damages, punish the media. Okay. Let's turn to defenses to libel. There are hardline and there are mitigating defenses. I'm going to start with hardline. Hardline defenses, as the win button in the corner says, are defenses that have a good opportunity, a good chance to win the libel case for the media defendant. So we'll start with those. Truth is usually 9.5 out of 10 times an absolute defense. Because again, if you think of libel as a six-legged table, okay, and you knock out the falsity leg, that means it's only got 5 legs to stand on, it's going to fall down. And we're going to talk about a case in which truth was not considered to be an absolute defense in a little bit. But most of the time, a plaintiff must prove falsity, and if they can't do it, if the media is actually able to prove truth, that knocks out the leg of the table, and the table falls. Now, again, to remind you, it is not a defense, as we talked about earlier, to print an accurate account of what someone else falsely said. So even if I'm quoting someone accurately, all right, unless it's from a government proceeding, which we'll talk about in a minute, all right, that is not necessarily a defense for me. Okay, I have to actually prove that the substance of what I'm republishing is true for this defense to work. Now, there are three kinds of privileges. Well, again, we'll be coming back to the truth defense in a little bit, but there are three kinds of privileges. There is the concept of absolute privilege, that the media has the First Amendment behind it. No matter what the media prints, no matter what, they are privileged. And that's pretty rare. The judge is going to say that's a nice argument, but you can go home now. But there's also something called a conditional or qualified privilege. You might also see it fair reporting, okay? This is a truthful coverage of a government proceeding or a document. And we'll see it in the Hutchinson case in just a minute. Okay? And finally, there is the constitutional privilege, the six-legged libel table we've been talking about. Okay? And that basically says that the media can prove truth or can knock out one of the other legs of that libel table, and the plaintiff must prove all six elements, and if they can't, the media wins. So the burden of proof, again, is on the plaintiff. The plaintiff is the one who has to prove, in a sense, guilt on the part of the media organization. Let's turn to the Hutchinson case real quick so I can explain qualified privilege. The Hutchinson case is about teeth-clenching monkeys, kind of. All right. It's actually about Senator Proxmire and Dr. Hutchinson. Senator Proxmire from my home state of Wisconsin used to issue in the day something called Golden Fleece Awards, where he would go to the floor of the Senate and he would stand there and he would say, you know, my fellow senators, I hereby award the Golden Fleece for the most monumental waste of public funding to Dr. Hutchinson, who studies the habits of teeth-clenching monkeys. Basically, this was a way for him to say that Congress wastes money all the time, which is probably something most of us know, and he was acknowledging or pointing out some of the wastes he thought were most egregious. The one year he picked on Dr. Hutchinson. Okay? Hutchinson had put out, had done this report on teeth-clenching monkeys and stress that was funded with government funds. And Proxmire had put out a press release. And the press release had essentially said, Hutchinson is wasting our tax dollars on this study. So what happens is there's a press release that is read in the press room to the reporters, and there is also Proxmire speaking on the floor of the Senate. When Proxmire speaks on the floor of the Senate, all right, he is privileged. However, the press release, which is not an official record, not a public record, is not privileged, even if it's verbatim between the two sources. So if Proxmire stands on the floor of the Senate and says, my fellow senators, here's my discussion of the most monumental waste of public funds, that is privileged. If reporters write on that, that is okay. However, if the office issues a press release, even if the stuff is the same, it isn't privileged. Let me give you another example that would be maybe strike a little closer to home. Let's say that I am on the Fullerton City Council, and Joe Smith, my opponent, is somebody I disagree with. And he and I are debating about how Fullerton's money should be spent on a public park. And I say, in the public meeting with all the reporters and all the other city council people there, I say, you know, city council member Smith is completely wrong on how to spend money. He doesn't really understand our budgetary process. He doesn't understand the procedure. And moreover, his wife sleeps around. And all the reporters are like, whoa, you know, they're usually expecting to be bored at a city council meeting. And here I am saying that the wife is sleeping around. So all their little reporters write this stuff, and it appears, and the probably would appear all over on the internet, on the, in the newspaper, on TV, everywhere. Okay? Now, Mr. Smith cannot sue any of these places necessarily for libel. Now, he may be able to sue me for some other things, but it is privileged for the media to report that stuff that took place in the city council meeting. Now, if I walk out on the courtroom steps, let's say we go out in front of the city council and there's all the reporters gathered around there, and I say the same thing, but it's not in the meeting, then there can be punishment for libel. It is really about the place the libel takes place, right? As opposed to the actual libel itself. If it's in a public meeting, there is a privilege for reporters to write about it, because it's important to get that information out there. Okay? All right. Let's talk about a few more hardline defenses. Fair comment and criticism has a defense as well. And that is really about whether or not something is really opinion. Okay? We'll talk about a case that illustrates that in just a few minutes. Now, if someone consents to let you libel them, I would be a little worried, because I think that's a setup. If somebody says, yeah, go ahead and print about me that I, you know, embezzled $1,500 from this account, well, I would be a little bit worried, because then it's kind of a setup. Okay? There is also something called a statute of limitations. In other words, a period of time that you, after which you cannot sue for libel. In California, it's 1 year. So if I publish something on January 1st and I allegedly libel someone, that person has 1 calendar year from the publication date to sue for libel. Most states have 1, 2, or 3 years of a statute of limitations. Okay? You've heard about it in other areas too. For example, on murder, there is no statute of limitations. You can prosecute for a murder 50 years after the murder takes place. That's not the case with libel. All right, let's talk about the fair comment and criticism, or the pure opinion defense. Comes out of a case called Milkovich versus Lorraine Journal. Okay? In this case, Mr. Milkovich, who's a high school wrestling coach, sues the Lorraine Journal, the newspaper, for alleging in a letter to their editorial that he had lied under oath. Okay? But the Lorraine Journal said, well, that was just our opinion. We thought he lied under oath. The court said, there is no constitutional privilege for opinion when based on false statements of fact, unsupported facts, or implied facts. Now, that seems like a lot of legal gobbledygook. Let's talk about it. If I say, I think Coke tastes better than Pepsi, and I do. They sell Pepsi products on campus, yuck. All right? That's really just opinion, right? That's pure opinion, because there are probably you right now listening to this going, no, Pepsi Man, or Dr. Pepper, or RC, or whatever, okay? That's pure opinion, because everybody's taste buds are a little bit differently. Now, if I say, I think Coke sells better than Pepsi in Orange County, you might be inclined to think that I know something that would lead me to believe that Coke sells better than Pepsi. In other words, I am basing my opinion, my I think, on implied fact. Okay? That kind of thing is not pure opinion. It is pure opinion if it cannot be proven one way or the other, like Coke is better than Pepsi, all right? So, for example, saying something like Jones is a bad mayor is defensible, because what does bad mean? You can't prove bad. But if you say, I think Jones embezzled money from the city, then you could actually prove that one way or the other. That is based on implied facts. The idea is pure opinion. If something really is pure opinion, it is protected. Okay? Now, simply tacking I think or I believe on the front of a statement doesn't rescue it. Because if I say I think Coke sells better than Pepsi, that doesn't really suggest that I know anything. Okay? So it's all about proving stuff. Now let's go back to my bad teacher example. Okay? The actionable phrase in the story is, I think Professor Belmis is a bad teacher because she gives men better grades than she gives women. There is an opinion statement in there, and there is a, you know, basically a non-pure opinion statement in there. As you probably have figured out by now, the pure opinion part is the bad teacher. What does bad teacher mean? Do I smell bad? You know, do I, you know, am I late to class all the time? Did I not take a shower that day? Whatever. Okay? But we could actually prove whether or not I give bad grades, you know, worse grades to women than to men by going back and looking at my documents, historical documents. So even though the writer prefaced all that with "I think," only part of that statement would be defensible as pure opinion. Okay. Let's talk about mitigating examples or mitigating defenses. Mitigating means reducing. So it's not necessarily a way for the media to win a libel case, but it is a way to have their damages reduced. Corrections and retractions go a long way to reducing punitive damages. Because you're saying, look, you know, we made a mistake here, we take it back, we really want to provide the right information, and as a result, we're not acting with actual malice. Okay, it's not, you don't necessarily win with that, but, you know, the correction needs to be made in a timely fashion. There are actually some state laws we'll talk about later in this chapter that provide for that, and it might be a way to reduce the damages even if the media were to lose the case. Now, I would argue that Britney Spears is a libel-proof plaintiff. So much stuff has happened to her, and she's been talked about so much in the media, that her reputation is so bad that nothing I say, or you say, or anyone else says, can actually harm her reputation more. Okay? In other words, you know, it's sort of like kicking a dead horse. You know, no matter what you do, it's not going to hurt her any more than she's already been hurt. This is not a great defense, but it is one that is often raised. There is also a concept called neutral reportage, a defense, which says that if you are reporting all issues of a controversial issues of public importance, parties on either side might libel the other. This defense is actively not recognized in California, but it is recognized in New York. So many of our media students go out to work in New York. You should know that that is a defense out there. There is also something called right of reply. It's kind of the same concept. If one media libels another media in the course of a discussion, in some cases the court forgives it all when it's really replying to each other's libels. Not a strong defense, but there it is. And finally, the usually reliable source defense. For example, the AP, the Associated Press, puts out wire services that many, many news organizations around the country use. 99 times out of 100, they are correct. Right? They do a really nice job verifying their facts and getting the news out very quickly. However, in that one time out of 100 when they're not, and somebody sues for libel, there might be a defense for the media to say, well, you know, 99 times out of 100, this is a reliable source. If it messed up once, we shouldn't be held quite as accountable. But again, all of these are mitigating defenses. They're not I win defenses. And that is the first half of Chapter 4. Thanks for your attention.